And welcome to Sitfa Speaks. This month, we have a very special episode for you that was recorded across both days of Public Finance Live, Sitfa's annual conference. The conference this year was held at the QE2 Conference Centre in central London, and we heard from some really fascinating speakers about a range of topics spanning economics, politics, global leadership, sustainability, and of course, public finance. On this episode, I'll speak to Caroline Atkinson, who is a global strategist at Rock Creek Asset Management. She is also an Oxford-trained economist with more than two decades' experience as a senior policymaker in international economics and finance in the US and UK. I'll also be speaking to Tom Burgess, who is an investigative reporter and author, and who has had a truly fascinating career. His book, Kleptopia: How Dirty Money is Conquering the World, was published in 2020, and it became an international bestseller. It reveals the rise of international kleptocracy, rule by theft, that is becoming the greatest threat to freedom today. Last but by no means least, we hear from Darshini David, who is a highly experienced broadcaster and economist who covers financial news for the BBC. In January 2020, she was appointed to be the BBC's first global trade correspondent. She has worked as an economist for the UK government, on the trading floor for HSBC Investment Bank, advised the Tesco board about broadcasting, and covered the credit crunch from Wall Street. All of these guests were so fascinating to talk to, and I thoroughly enjoyed recording the interviews with them, so I hope you enjoy listening. Just a quick note before we begin, this episode was recorded in the press room at PF Live, and because of this there is some slight background noise, so I do apologise about that. Hopefully it's not too distracting. So with all that being said, let's get into the episode. So I'm here with Caroline Atkinson, who gave today's earlier keynote address at PF Live. Caroline, thank you for being with us today. In your keynote address entitled Wither the World, you spoke about the period of sea change that we are in, and in particular, you pointed out some key changes that have happened over the last few years that have added to the sea change. Could you tell us a bit about those?
Yes, well, I was thinking just in the less than a decade, there have been five largely unforeseen and mostly quite extraordinary events that have changed the world. The first happened here in the UK was Brexit, which was a surprise and really indicated the degree of popular disaffection with people's lives and with the elites and experts. The second closely followed was the election of Donald Trump in the US, despite his lack of experience, his extraordinary behaviour at times, and he then rejected a lot of the normal behaviours of America, including he left the Paris Climate Accord, he threatened NATO, and gave up the idea of American leadership, in a sense, certainly the guarantor of the world order, and he also had a fight with China. Then you had, obviously, COVID, which really turned upside down many people's lives around the world and, of course, was tragic in ending some people's lives and changed the ways that we lived and worked. Then you had the war in Ukraine, the outbreak of the war in Ukraine in 2022, which, again, was an extraordinary thing to have a land war in Europe. And finally, the cost of living crisis, the inflationary surge that followed in particular from the pandemic and the related government policies and from the war in Ukraine, and that contributed to the sense of instability and that I think is disorienting for many people now.
So mentioning Trump, in your keynote address, you also spoke about the challenges over the next few years being political challenges rather than economic ones. In the UK and USA, we'll be gearing up for elections next year. How do you think this distrust in leaders that you mentioned will affect the results of those elections? And why do you think these periods of change allow dangerous or polarising figures like Trump to step into power?
Well, to take the second question first, what Trump and, in a sense, the supporters of Brexit did, I think, was appeal not to people's better instincts, but to people's fears. And understandable fears in some cases, and one way to make people feel better can be to define an enemy And that happened definitely in the case of Brexit, the enemy with Europe and Brussels and bureaucrats and so on. In the case of the US, the enemy was pretty much everybody who had changed the way the US was. There was a lot of subterranean or what we call dog whistle call-outs to racist sentiment and just a general... and China was an enemy and foreigners were an enemy. And that then provokes divides, because once people articulate blame on somebody rather than a call to let's all work together, we are all in one world, one nation, it exacerbates divides. So that's the second part of your question. The first part is, I'm worried about the elections. Not so much actually in the UK. I think you've got two leaders of the respective parties, main parties here, who are, you know, sensible in some way and have different views about what should be done, but are both kind of responsible individuals. I think in the United States, I would certainly think that Biden has achieved an enormous amount. He is a responsible and ethical leader, but of course there's the concerns about his age. Donald Trump is likely to be his opponent from the Republican side, and Donald Trump is completely unfit, in my view, to be president. He has broken the law, most likely. I mean, he's certainly been indicted for serious offences, and he behaved very irresponsibly on a number of issues when he was president before. And since leaving the presidency, he has ginned up this idea that it was all unfair and that he really won the 2020 election, which goes against a fundamental issue in democracy, which is when you lose and you leave and you congratulate the other person and move on.
So you mentioned there a distrust between the USA and China that has been developing. And in your speech, you mentioned the aggressive stance that the USA has taken towards China. Where has that come from and how do you think it will develop? Is that something that you're concerned about?
I am concerned about it because I think it's, this may sound sort of cliche, but we are all in one world. The major challenges that we face, and I'll just point to climate change, is one that can only be resolved if you have the big countries. And now China is by far the biggest emitter currently of greenhouse gases. If you have people working together, leaders working together to resolve those issues. So there are other problems. Obviously, there's the danger of some sort of military confrontation, which I don't think is going to happen, but the risk of it is much higher than it than is comfortable. So I think in the United States, again, it's easier to work people up if you define an enemy, and so part of the animus against China is about that. There is also a genuine concern that grew up over the fact that China was welcomed, if you like, into the world trading system, joined the WTO, was given various special exemptions as a developing nation, and it continued with policies that were quite unfair to its trading partners, big subsidies for state-owned industries, some industrial espionage that was perhaps went beyond even what other countries would do, and for a long time an undervalued exchange rate, which meant that their goods were very attractively cheap. And that delivered what has been called the China shock, particularly in the United States, where people lost their jobs because it was cheaper to produce in China in particular. And whilst that had the advantage for many families of providing cheap goods in Walmart and other stores, and many of us wear clothes that were made in China that were cheaper than they would be if they were made in America, that's a very kind of diffuse benefit, whereas the cost of factory closing down in a town is very direct and painful for those involved.
So to move on to a different topic altogether, you briefly mentioned AI at the end of your keynote address. What's your take on AI kind of going forward? It's becoming much more of a spoken about topic now.
Is it something that you think will affect governmental policy and local government policy? Is it something that we're going to see more of?
Well, I think there are two different aspects of AI. One is that it is a huge sort of technological leap, and it should make possible a lot of innovations that will relieve some of the, you know, more rote work that is very important within government, within local government, and so on. It should make transparency easier, which is always good because, you know, sunlight's the best bleach on practices, and for public finance accountants, that's very important to have information, more information, make it easier to analyse and accumulate information. So, as well as promote some technological advances. All of that, I think, is exciting and good. There is obviously a concern that people have that will AI somehow deprive people of work, take away jobs? And my bias is to think that the humanness of humans is not something that can be replicated even by, you know, intelligent artificial computer programs. The empathy, the creativity of humans is still ability to communicate and to be sort of have relationships is something special, and I think will remain something special and important.
And you mentioned that those kind of human skills are going to become more important going into the future because of things like AI.
Yeah, I think that's right. There was a big push, obviously, to have what's called, in America at any rate, STEM, science, technology, mm-hmm. and math, maths education. Those skills are very important, I think, but the other skills of that you get from learning about different cultures, learning history, geography, literature, are ones that are also going, I think, to be more important going forward, relatively speaking, because it's easier to get a computer program to learn how to code, for example, than it is to develop relationships, as I said. So I think these humanities are very important to continue to have people learn and understand.
Fantastic. Caroline Atkinson, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Caroline Atkinson, Global Strategist at Rock Creek Asset Management. Up next, we'll hear from Tom Burgess, investigative journalist and author.
Okay, so I'm joined at PF Live by Tom Burgess, who is an investigative journalist. Thank you for joining us today. So you spoke earlier about kleptocracy, which I have to admit is the first time I've heard that word today, earlier during the session. Could you explain for our listeners what that means?
Yeah, I mean, kleptocracy is the most important force in the world today. And what it means is when corruption becomes the system. So what you'd hope is that when corruption is discovered in politics or business or wherever it may be, or even sometimes in accounting, that the system kicks in. Yeah, the fourth estate, the media come across these stories, mm-hmm. Public bodies come across these stories, there are political inquiries, there are criminal investigations and so on, and corruption is the aberration, it's the thing that goes wrong with the system. Kleptocracy is when corruption is what the system's for. So you seek power in order to enrich yourself and to use that fortune to create a patronage system that allows you to get more power, to steal more money, to buy more power, and so on. Kleptocracy, or like rule through theft, rule through corruption, is how most of the world runs. That's largely because most economies are just essentially producers of oil and minerals. That creates a big pot of money in the centre for whoever you can capture it. And if you're a foreign investor or a multinational company, you pay the bribes to the right people, you get access to that mineral wealth you can turn into money. And what's happening is that international, transnational networks of kleptocrats are forming. So it might be a Zimbabwean dictator, a Kazakh oligarch, a British peer, and a Wall Street banker doing a big deal together that lets the dictator win an election, lets the oligarch secure corruptly mining rights, lets the British peer make some money sitting on the board of the oligarch's company when it's listed in London, and lets the Wall Street banker make a huge bonus from arranging the financing for all of this. And more these kleptocratic networks are emerging. They're concentrating power among the kleptocrats, And then suddenly what we're seeing is that kleptocracy has gone violent. So the invasion of Ukraine is one of the world's great kleptocrats, Putin, profited for so long from the complicity of Western economies and Western politicians, using that unaccountable kleptocratic power that he's gathered and going to war with it.
So you mentioned earlier it was kind of focused on London and these bogus companies that have been set up in London and kind of all the dirty money that's going through London. Could you just give us an idea of the situation in London as it currently stands?
Right. If you want to set up a company in London, and you may well want to set up a company in London because it's got this kind of veneer of legitimacy, right? A UK company. Mm. Take that to any bank in the world and the bank manager's no doubt going to be impressed and say, okay, you're a legit, you're a real thing, no doubt. No doubt every penny of this, the money in this company's bank accounts is squeaky clean and the proceeds of legitimate business. What you have to do is you have to submit some documents about the identity of the founder of this company, the owner of it. These documents aren't checked, and when they are found to be bogus, very, very occasionally, there's little or no sanction for that. So what happens is UK companies, thousands upon thousands of them, have been created by the world's kleptocrats, Putin's allies, kleptocrats from China, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and so on, use the UK company formation system as one of the layers of camouflage by which they move their loot into Western economies and turn it into legitimate looking assets that they're free to then spend.
I think a lot of people would be really shocked to hear how dire the situation is in London in particular. Do you think kind of public or indeed professional awareness is lacking, or do you think it's kind of something that people just don't really want to face up to?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there's a financial secrecy system, which is the fundamental problem. Like, no one's ever voted for, no political party's ever put in its manifesto, I think people should be able to operate in our economy behind a mask. That's something that's a weird quirk that sort of mutated out of the sort of British imperial commerce, tax evasion and globalisation, and the development of these kind of offshore financial centres like the British Virgin Islands and so on, where you can go and essentially buy financial camouflage and then walk around the world in it. So part of the problem is that, you know, even an accountant operating in the best good faith struggles when they come up against these layer upon layer of often impenetrable financial secrecy. How are you supposed to vet a customer when they're dealing through a Liechtenstein trust inside a BVI shell company with dummy directors from Panama? How are you supposed to arrive at the truth? So that's part of it. But what that creates is the opportunity to embrace ignorance for our own benefit. So the fact that we allow in the UK secretly owned companies or corporations where the beneficial ownership is very blurry and vague and often distorted, the fact that we allow these companies to operate allows us, it gives us a kind of blank piece of paper on which we can write a different story. So for decades we've been welcoming Russian money, even as Putin and his regime started invading parts of Europe, started murdering their opponents, started using chemical weapons on the streets of London. We continued to tell ourselves that the money coming from Russia was legitimate. Why? Because the City of London and other UK interests made massive profits off it, off the listings, off the legal fees, off the accountancy fees and so on. So we've been complicit in the rise of kleptocracy. There's no two ways about it.
So most of our listeners are public finance professionals who work in kind of local authorities, public services. And earlier on, the accountants were called the front line of defence against corruption. So in terms of public sector accountants, what can they do to help prevent corruption and corrupt behaviour?
Well, one important point, I mean, most of the people we're talking about are in the UK, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one important thing is that I think in the UK, we often use euphemisms to talk about corruption. If a Nigerian governor had doled out massive health contracts to a lot of his mates during a pandemic, we wouldn't have hesitated to call that out as corruption, rightly so. In the UK, we call it a fast lane, we call it a chumocracy, but we saw massive corruption during the pandemic in the UK, massive political corruption. Now, the role of public accountants, I think, is so crucial here, because what we're starting to see after all these decades of the UK absorbing kleptocratic money from elsewhere is this sort of kleptocrification of UK politics. The fact that politics in the UK is increasingly being used the way politics in Kazakhstan is used, which is to enrich the holders of public office,
mm-hmm.
one way or another, whether it's a revolving door, whether it's abuse of COVID contracting or whatever it may be, whether it's abuse of the political donation system, which is also rife. And what's going to be absolutely crucial if the UK is to kind of stand up to this onslaught of dirty money is the role of public accountants in maintaining scrutiny of the public finances, which are the heart of kleptocracy everywhere. The diversion of public funds is the engine of kleptocracy, whether it's in, you know, Iran or Venezuela or the Central African Republic. And the creep of that notion of corruption as the creep into UK politics of the purpose of power being self-enrichment and the enrichment of your friends, basically. The way to counter that is by rigorous public accounting.
And earlier on you were talking about kind of reform and legislation that needs to happen in the overarching system to kind of stop this kind of corruption. What should the government, or, you know, what kind of legislation needs to be put in place? And is there any kind of positive examples of work being done to put that in place anywhere in the world?
There is some good news, which is that since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year, 2022, we've woken up to the connection between kleptocracy and security. So we've woken up to the fact that we have been complicit in creating a corrupt dictatorship in Russia that's now used the power it's assembled through its kleptocracy to go to war. Now, what that means is there's a lot more political attention on countering dirty money, and some of the legislation we've had, there's been sort of, there have now been two economic crime pieces of legislation that have contained very promising new tools for law enforcement and for enforcement of sanctions. Things like trying to force people to declare great unexplained wealth. Things like making it very difficult to do sanctions busting. And there are lots of good examples of this. The problem is that so far, these new tools haven't really been matched by funding for the law enforcement agencies that are supposed to use these tools. And the danger is that you get a kind of hologram. You get what looks like a fantastic set of defences against dirty money, but actually there's nothing there because the Serious Fraud Office, the National Crime Agency and so on, lack the really big increases in resources and personnel that they would need to use those tools effectively.
Fantastic. Well, Tom Burgess, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tom Burgess, investigative journalist and author. Up next, we'll hear from Darshini David, broadcaster and economist.
So I'm joined at PF Live by Darshini David, broadcaster and economist. Thank you very much for being with us today. So last week we saw the Bank of England raise interest rates to 5%, which is the highest level that we've seen in 15 years. As an economist, is this what you expected and do you agree with the decision?
It's a really tricky one, isn't it? I mean, 5%, as you say, highest in 15 years. It's the 13th interest rate rise in the last 15 months. So it's 13th time, very unlucky indeed for many mortgage holders out there who will be seeing the kind of pain they haven't seen at all during the course of being homeowners. And it's a truly terrifying time for many. But in terms of what the Bank of England has at its disposal when it wants to tackle inflation and its remit is all about getting inflation back down, and it's stayed up harder and longer and higher than it should have done or many people expected it to, interest rates are the main tool for getting them down. And quite frankly, it has become increasingly uncertain about how those interest rates work because it takes time. Now, there is actually a smaller proportion of us on variable rate mortgages than they were, say, 20 years ago. So it takes a lot longer for these changes to feed through the system than they used to, and no one's quite sure of the impact they will have ultimately. And also, of course, banks have been very slow to pass on rates to savers as well, which makes things even more complicated. So the Bank of England have an unenviable job, I think, but quite frankly, there is a lot of uncertainty about how this will all end. You know, are they going to raise rates enough to get inflation back under control? Are we going to be caught up in this destabilising cycle of high inflation for a while? Or do they overshoot, go too far? And ultimately, what some I'm hearing in policy making in the world of economic forecasting are now worrying about is, are we looking at the risk of a recession around the end of this year, beginning of next year? And with that, perhaps, could we see a rise in unemployment, which is not something, of course, we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think that's everyone's fear, isn't it, really? So, I mean, I'm no economist, but from my understanding, the point of raising interest rates is to slow spending down, thus lowering prices. But so far, that's not what we're seeing, which I don't think is what the Bank of England or the government expected. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we're not seeing that?
It's absolutely the way interest rates are meant to work. You know, we have that John Major quote that we keep hearing about now. You know, if it isn't hurting, it isn't working. And that is the unfortunate truth. And you know, it comes as a shock because people aren't used to this idea of interest rates rising in the way they have been recently. But yes, it is all about trying to take the heat out of what is going on in the economy. You know, suck out some of that cash, make sure that spending doesn't rise at the rate at which businesses feel comfortable about keeping to passing on higher prices, and also limiting businesses' finances as well, trying to make sure that their profits aren't rising at such a rate, and it limits the amount in theory that they could, for example, put wages up by. I think what we forget is that these things take time, and you know, the old rule of thumb that we used to use when I worked on a trading floor was it would take a year to see a change in interest rates today impacting on activity, and perhaps 2 years to see it impacting on inflation, which is why you don't see the press the button and immediately you see the, you know, with the Amazon Prime generation, we're used to things happening very quickly. That's not how interest rates work. And the whole mechanism has become more uncertain. And there's an additional factor this time round as well, because we've seen perhaps fewer workers out there to fill vacancies. And that's meant there's been skill shortages up and down the economy, partly because of Brexit, partly because some people after the pandemic haven't come back into work, some are long-term sick. And that puts an additional pressure on employers to keep wages rising faster. So that too adds the pressure on prices. There's another reason why inflation perhaps hasn't come down in the way some had expected. But things will change quite rapidly. A lot of those higher costs we saw after Russia's invasion of Ukraine are going to filter out of the system in the coming months. Inflation will come down. We're just still not quite sure about how fast that's going to happen.
It's so true what you say about the Amazon Prime generation. I think everyone these days does expect things to happen now, very quickly, but we might just have to hang on that little bit longer. So you covered the credit crunch from Wall Street. I'd be really fascinated to know what you remember from that time and what your experience was of reporting on such a dramatic event.
Oh gosh, I'd like to say it's all a blur, but I've been having a lot of deja vu in recent days and weeks. I still remember I was working in New York at the time, and it was, I think, summer of 2006, and going to an economist's office to film an interview, and he said, before we do that, just take a look at this. This is housing starts in the US. It's a forward-looking indicator. And he said, I've got my own composite indicator I've made up as a result of this, and this is what it suggests is going to happen to the housing market and consumer spending. And the line sort of goes up very gradually, and then it just falls off a cliff. And I looked at it, the cameraman looked at it, and he literally put down his equipment, and we both stood there and stared at this chart. And we just looked at the economist and went, how likely is this? And he said, I'm hoping it doesn't come to pass. Now, we know what happened after that. Mm. And it was a real issue, because obviously what started off as being an issue for some mortgage holders in parts of America then became very much an issue for Wall Street. And that, you know, my job at the time was explaining how that could impact our audiences back in the UK. You know, the crisis on Wall Street becomes a crisis on Main Street UK. Mm. Now, we know, and hindsight is a brilliant thing, that that financial crisis and the work that was done around it stopped it becoming the kind of economic crisis it could have been. And when we look at what was done at the time, some of the safeguards that were put into place then have actually, when you look at what we're looking at, the situation we're looking at now, we've got an economic crisis, but it limits the risk of that tipping over into an all right financial crisis because of some of those sort of more, you know, it felt prosaic at the time, some of the regulations and safeguards that were put into place, but you can see that they are coming into play now, and they should also limit the pain that individual mortgage holders feel this time around as well.
Mm. It must have been such a fascinating time to be an economist. So to ask a slightly more political question, we heard yesterday from Caroline Atkinson, and she gave more of a global perspective on politics and leadership that we're seeing at the moment. And she was saying that, because I know we're kind of gearing up for an election next year, possibly in the US and the UK kind of fairly close together. Caroline Atkinson was saying that she is far more worried about the situation in the US than she would be about in the UK, because she was saying that in the UK we have two very sensible candidates who have sensible ideas and sensible policies. And that struck me, and I was wondering what your take would be on that.
As a BBC employee, I'm wholly impartial about the political aspects of these things. So I'll answer with the point of view of being an economist. And I think it's a fascinating time to take power, whichever side of the Atlantic you're on. And I say that because we know that trust in our politicians is very low indeed, and it doesn't matter, for example, in the UK, which party you're in. There is a sense of doubt that has come through and has festered in the most recent years. And on top of that, we are seeing populations on both sides of the Atlantic where, frankly, people are feeling that they haven't got their fair share. You know, many incomes just haven't budged since that financial crisis, which you take away inflation and tax changes. So they feel like the social contract is broken. The idea that your children can have a better life, standard of living than you did, and that you are going to have a better one than your parents did, that seems to have gone by the wayside. So I think whoever takes power on either side of the Atlantic has an unenviable task of trying to rebuild that and finding a different recipe for prosperity in the 21st century. And let's not forget, the experience on both sides of the Atlantic in the past few years means that, frankly, electorates are more cynical. And so any claims that are made are going to be tested more. And I think, you know, we've been hearing over the course of the second day about the importance of statistics in telling us what's going on. And I think there's going to be more weight placed on making sure those numbers are accurate and telling a fair story.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very interesting time for whoever takes power. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in both of those elections, actually. So, Doshini David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Doshini David, broadcaster and economist. That's all we have time for on today's episode. I'd like to say a huge thank you to our guests, Caroline Atkinson, Tom Burgess and Doshini David. We really appreciate your time. We'd also like to say a big thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this PF Live special episode. Make sure you follow us on social media for more and to make sure you never miss another episode. Previous episodes can be found on SITVA's website or wherever you like to listen. Thank you again and goodbye.